Well, good morning. My name is Ben. I'm a pastor here and staff at 12 South. We're glad you're here with us. If I have not had a chance to meet you, I'd love to right that ship, so you can find me after the service. I'll be around, or I'll be wherever I am, if that's helpful for you to know that. That's where you are when you are yourself. So, but we are in the middle of a sermon series in the book of John. It's about two-thirds through the Bible. The book of John is a gospel. It kind of has this account of what is the person of Jesus, what's he about, what has he done. And for us, we're kind of dropping the RPMs and the speed, and we're going to move very slowly through the book of John, really at the pace of Jesus, which is intentional and slow and very revealing also. As we do so, we're seeing kind of this theme and thread all throughout the book of John, which is this: he's a Messiah. That's what he is. He's a Savior. He's a Redeemer. He's come to us. He's come to liberate us. He's come to free us. He's a Messiah, but here's the deal. He's often and almost even always a misunderstood Messiah. That those he comes to, those he comes for, those he comes to be with, they don't get who he is. They don't get what he's about. They don't understand his agenda. They don't get, our small little paradigms, Jesus doesn't fit into those. And so oftentimes there's a dissonance between who he is and how we perceive him, and who we perceive him to be and what we perceive him to do. So that's misunderstood Messiah. To those he's come to, he's misunderstood by. And so all throughout we're looking at this theme, and this morning we kind of see this theme of misunderstood freedom. Misunderstood freedom. Now, I can say the word freedom, and you can think of the things that you have. You can think of freedom. You're American. You got freedom, red, white, and blue. You can think of things that you don't have, because actually you're constrained by things in life. You can think of the time you don't have, or the freedom of all these kind of things that you don't have. When I say the word freedom, everything can come to mind, whether you things you have or things you don't have. I had a friend, we're moving from Chattanooga, my wife and I, and we were there for about 12 years, and in those kind of time there, we had a friend named Marnie, and here's what Marnie said, and I can't unhear it and forget it, and it's this: we're all trying to figure out what it looks like to live more free. We're all trying to figure out what the life of freedom really looks like, and then stepping into and leading a life that's marked with more freedom. And so with that understood and understanding, we're kind of here and seeing, Jesus, what do you say freedom really looks like? So, as we look into John 8, look with me in verse 31 in your Bibles or on the screen. We can see what this story has for us this morning. So John 8, verse 31 and on, it says this, God's word. It says, so Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, you're truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say we will become free?" And Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the Father's house forever, the Son remains forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my words find no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father." So, John 8, talking all about freedom. If the Son sets you free, you're free indeed. If enslavement, all these kind of motifs and paradigms and words. And so this morning, I've got two thoughts, two points for us, not three. I'm going to break the mold on the sermon. Here it is: false freedom and true freedom. John 8 teaches us those two things, false freedom and true freedom. So first off, what does John 8 show us of false freedom? What is false freedom from Jesus? He's trying to get these Jewish people to understand. What does false freedom really look like? So Jesus is going about teaching, and he's kind of at the point in his ministry that actually he has many followers, even a mob following him, of allegiance with him, of learning from him. And also, conversely, there's also people who don't like him, don't care for Jesus much. There's many Jews, actually, who want to entrap Jesus. There's a lot of kind of things that they want to make sure that he stops doing what he's doing, because what's happening is the things that he's teaching, the things that he's doing, they're losing power because of it. standing because of it. Actually, they're not good for their business. He's not good for their business. And so they want to get rid of Jesus. Well, turns out, as they're there to entrap Jesus, some people are beginning to believe in this Jesus, actually. That these Jews are coming to faith and believing in Jesus. And we see here in John 8, he's teaching about this. Hey, I'm the Son of Man, and I will suffer and I'll be lifted up, which in their mind, it would have been popping off of this kind of threads being pulled in the Old Testament. And he's saying, hey, I have a Father in heaven. And also he says this, I'm the light of the world. He's saying all of these things, and it says people are believing in him. And that's where we pick up the story in John 8. The people are believing. They're jumping on Team Jesus. And here's what we see. In verse 31, it says, so Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, people who are coming to faith in him, here's what he says. If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So he's saying, if you abide in me, the domino will fall. And here's what will fall, the next domino, that you'll be my disciple. And also then after that, you'll know this truth that I give you. And then after that, you'll know true freedom. We'll talk all about those things in just a second. But he's saying all these words of saying, hey, you're believing in me. Well, here's the next step for you to really lean into, to take up, to say, this is what my life of following Jesus looks like, is this. Now, you would think their response would be this, great, we're in. Like, where's the dotted line? I'll sign on the dotted line. Where do I sign up? Tell us more even. Like, what is this? Oh, we want to know more. We're hungry. Not so fast, Lee Corso. Here's what they say. Here's their response. To if you abide in me, you're my disciple, you'll have truth, and you'll be set free. Here's what they say in response to Jesus. We are offspring of Abraham. We've never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? Their response doesn't make them closer to Jesus. Actually, their response is saying, hey, actually, we're distinct from you, Jesus. We are the offspring of Abraham. We have never been enslaved. How is it that you say that we will be set free? They don't fight Jesus on him saying, abide in me. They don't fight Jesus on saying, hey, be my disciple. They don't fight Jesus on saying, hey, I have the truth. And they fight Jesus on freedom. They fight Jesus on this baked-in word, this kind of implicit word that says this, you actually are enslaved, Jews. That's the sticking point. That's what they lean into. And they say to him, we are the offspring of Abraham. We have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? They're fighting Jesus on freedom, and they're trying to prove to him, we are free. We're not enslaved. But the thing is, if you know anything about the Old Testament, anything about the story of God's people, and just anything about history, you know they were enslaved. If you look back at Egypt, they were enslaved for hundreds of years. And the Exodus happened, and they're freed. They're delivered, the Red Sea, all of that good stuff. And then also, hundreds of years later, after they have an empire, and they have a king with the throne of David, and David has a son, and David's sons have a son, everything falls apart, and what happens? They're in captivity. Someone has come and overtaken them, the Assyrians. And after that, the overtakers are overtaken by the Babylonians. And even right now, in this setting of John 8, the Romans are over them. And yet they say, we have never been enslaved once before. That doesn't really add up. That doesn't make sense. So what are they saying? They're saying no one has ever enslaved us is their way of saying we are the spiritually chosen. We are God's people. We are. Their initial response is a identity language. We are Abraham's offspring. Jesus touches on their identity, and he trips the wire of saying you're not free. And what they immediately go to is, of course we're free because we have this identity. Because for them, freedom and identity go hand in hand. And their response is this. Hey, we're important, actually. We're important. Jesus, hey, we're important because we are Abraham's offspring. Ron Burgundy, like, we're kind of a big deal. I don't know if you heard of us, Jesus. They immediately show to him, here's how free we are. We have an identity because we're important. Next, we see kind of in their responsiveness to Jesus, they're dismissive. Jesus says, hey, you'll be free. And they respond to him, dude, we've always been free. Like, we've never been enslaved. They see this kind of claim coming at them, and they immediately poke holes in it and saying, we have never, ever, ever been enslaved, ever. They're dismissive of a claim against them. And lastly, they're doubting. Like, they doubt Jesus. They're putting it back on Jesus. It's this kind of technical word of the echo question. When someone asks you a question, you spit that question right back at them. How could you say, we will never be enslaved? They're taking this blow in from Jesus, kind of reworking it, and then putting it right back on him. With their importance, with their dismissiveness, and with their doubting of Jesus. It's really masterfully unhealthy. In their response, the Jews show they are existing in a false freedom. And what a false freedom actually means is this: they're enslaved. And here's what that enslavement, here's what false freedom really looks like, as we see in this vignette of the people who are coming after Jesus. False freedom is living defensively of your identity, that you're important, that you're chosen, and that you're untouchable. That living defensively because of your identity of being important and chosen and untouchable. That's what false freedom is. Living defensively doesn't mean you're free, actually. Living defensively means this: you're bound up by something. You're having to defend yourself to someone because you're defending something. And you have to defend yourself because the thing that you think makes you so important is being touched on, is being threatened. That's why they're saying to him, hey, dude, don't go near our identity, because that's actually what makes us so important. That's what makes us so free. And that shows how they're bonded and they're existing in a false freedom. Because the thing that they find identity in is being touched on and threatened. And therefore, they're in this false freedom. Now, growing up, I've got a lot of siblings, six of six kids, and all of the boys in our family played football. And of my oldest brothers, he was good. He's good at the old pigskin. And so he actually was nominated for this award called Mr. Football. No small thing. And so I'm the youngest, he's the oldest, and I thought, this is the greatest thing of all time. Because actually what happens, I got out of school for this big football, Mr. Football ceremony, and we all went in the family rig and went out to Opryland. And thousands of people came to see my brother win Mr. Football. That's how it felt as a third grader, seeing my brother be nominated for the award of the sport. He was my hero. And spoiler alert, he didn't win. Just set the pedigree of the Hoopers coming in second. So he didn't win. My world was crushed. This next week, I found myself on the elementary school playground. And we're playing football at recess. Chilling out, Max, relaxing out, cool. And so I'm there on the playground and playing football, my team versus that team, and I'm lining up on the line of scrimmage against someone named John. I won't say his full name because actually some of you even know him. And so I'm lining up against John, and we're kind of trash talking. He's third grade, you know, yip yap. And he says, hey, we're going to beat you. I said, I bet you are. And he says, no, you're going to lose just like your brother lost last week, Mr. Football. He went there. He went there. He touched the untouchable. So I said to John, that's really hurtful. No, I didn't say that. I said, John, what's so unhealthy in you that you would want to say that to me? I didn't say that either. Because here's what third grade Ben did. Third grade Ben punched John in the face. I remember it like yesterday. Even a teacher came over. It's still a little side. A teacher came over, and because there's this big crowd going on and yelling, and Miss P, her name was Miss P, she was wearing a green shirt, I remember it today, and she came up and she said, what's happening? And said, Ben punched John in the face. And why'd you do that? I said, well, he made fun of my brother for losing Mr. Football. And she's kind of like, it's kind of what you get, John. How'd it coming, John? Now, why would 10-year-old Ben choose to be charged with battery? It's because John touched something I had to defend. Because actually, my brother's Mr. Footballness gave me something that made me important, that made me chosen, that made me untouchable, that gave me an identity. And John went and touched it. And what's happened to me there's a defensiveness of the thing that makes me me because someone is threatening the thing that makes me me. What do we see in the Jews in this story? And what do we see at the Grass Elementary School playground? Is that the things that make us us, the things that we demand to make us something, we will have to defend when that thing is threatened. The reality is, their reality is not our reality. Because I bet if someone said to you, hey, and kind of touched on this identity of you being Abraham's offspring, you wouldn't get that defensive. You wouldn't get that feisty. So the question is, what is a modern day equivalent of the thing that they're experiencing that we experience? The thing that says to us that actually we're existing in this false freedom of this thing that gives us identity, but actually we have to be defensive of it when it's threatened. And that defensiveness shows that we're in bondage to it. What is a modern day example of that? Talking about it this week with Elliot and Joseph and others, we kind of realized here's what a modern day false freedom is. It's not this kind of ancestry from Abraham. Here's what a modern day example of it is. It's that we love and live for autonomy. The modern day example of false freedom is autonomy. And here's what autonomy is. It literally means self-law, law of self. It's that I get to create the laws and the way in which the world works, the way in which you should operate around me, because I'm the center of everything. I'm the one that holds all the power. You live in my world. And in my world, I'm king. And when I'm king, I create all the rules of what you can do and can't do, should do and shouldn't do, will do and won't do. This law of rule and reign of me, of governing life with my ideals, of the things that I want, when I want it, how I want it. It's like Burger King, have it your way. That's what autonomy says to me. If you think about it, think about everything that consumes your mind, the things that you daydream about, the things that you go to sleep thinking about, wake up thinking about, the things that consume kind of your headspace, even your heart space. Things like this, things like I'm frustrated with other people. I can think about their failures often, how they failed me. I can think about often and consume with how do I get what I most need and what I most want, how I'm leveling up, how there's a ladder that I'm going to climb, this belief in the system and this hamster wheel that I'm on of advancing and self-actualizing, how I'm actually living in a world where there's many, many spoken rules that you have to play by, and there's even more unspoken rules that you have to play by. And all of those things are the rudder to the ship of me, because I live by and live into, and you better too also, autonomy of me. There was a famous commencement speech given by David Foster Wallace almost 20 years ago at Kenyon College, and here's what he says, this famous author who was not following the person of Jesus and yet nails and reads the way the heart works. Here's what he says. I know it's hard to be read to, but here's what he says. He says, here is just one example of the total wrongness of something I tend to automatically be sure of. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I'm the absolute center of the universe. The realest, most vivid, and important person in existence is me. We really think about this sort of natural, basic self-centeredness because it's so socially repulsive. But it's pretty much the same for all of us. It's our default setting. It's our hardwire setting into our boards at birth. Think about it. There's no experience you have had that you are not the absolute center of. The world as you experience it is there in front of you, behind you, to the left or right of you, on your TV, on your monitor, and so on. Other people's thoughts and feelings have to be communicated to you somehow, but your own thoughts and feelings are immediate, urgent, and real. If you are automatically sure that you know what reality is, and you're operating on your default setting, then you, like me, probably won't consider possibilities that aren't annoying or miserable. Meaning you see the world and everything's interpreted as, that's so annoying. I'm so miserable. and the so-called real world will discourage you from operating, from not operating on your default setting, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along in a pool of fear, anger, frustration, craving, and worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom, the freedom all to be lords of our tiny, skull-sized kingdoms alone at the center of all creation. Sorry. What is David Foster Wallace saying? The talk he's giving is called "This is Water," because he's pointing out this is the water we all swim in. This self-importance, this kind of self-centeredness, the way in which everything operates around us, everything is kind of privy to and must go through our interpretation and our paradigm and our grid. And it's so much so the water we swim in, autonomy is so the false freedom that we know that we don't even realize it. But actually, this false freedom of living in autonomy, of self-law, has me see the world through me in a way that makes me important and chosen and untouchable. And for it not to fall apart, and therefore for me not to fall apart, I have to defend it. When it's threatened, I have to be defensive. So, like the Jews who have a false freedom, so do we. So let's take what they did and apply it to us. Here's a litmus test. When do you, like them, get most defensive? When do you kind of pop up your defense mechanisms, your walls? When do you get most defensive? And when you are most defensive, what is the thing in which has been touched on that you pull shield for, that you hide behind, that you have to protect? Or better yet, let's look at them. What did their defensiveness look like? They said they're important. They were Abraham's offspring. And for us, it can sound like this. Like, do you know how big of a deal I am? Like, do you know who I am? Because I know who I am. I know what I think of myself. Or also the defense mechanism that they use of dismissiveness. Hey, I'm gonna poke holes in the thing that you're coming at me with. Or even what they say of doubting the person who's talking to them. How do you even say that? Jesus, how can you even say that? Hey, person who's threatening me, how can you even say that? A litmus test. Where are you most defensive and about what? And can I offer something? Can I offer the option that in our defensiveness, maybe it's because someone has violated a law of our autonomy. Maybe they've tripped the wire of breaking a law that I've set up for the way in which you have to live by. I'm defensive because you've broken a law, and now all of a sudden, I've got to make sure I'm protected. They've broken and kind of gotten near and threatened some kind of comfort of mine or convenience of mine, or a plan of mine, or maybe a pet of mine, not like a fur baby pet, but like a thing in which I feed it and it gives me something in return. I'm defensive because they violated the self-law of the ladder I climb. They've gotten in between the narrative I believe and they're rivaling it, of the goals and expectations I want from life. There's a false freedom of autonomy because actually there's no freedom in it at all. It's false because we're in bondage to live more for me, get what I want, when I want it, how I want it, and you best live that way. And when you don't, I will be defensive of what I most want. And therefore, I'll strive, I'll defend, I'll attain, I'll compare. And striving and defending and attaining and comparing is things and verbs that this city loves to see. So we need to discover more and more this false freedom that we're operating in, all so that we really can see what true freedom looks like. So the question is, what does true freedom look like? This Jews give a perfect picture of what it looks like to be in bondage of false freedom, of an identity in this kind of source and this well of which that says, I am so important. So what does true freedom look like? True freedom is what Jesus wants for them, and also true freedom is Jesus wants the same for us. And he says the words at the beginning in verse 31, hey, abide in me and be my disciple and be shaped by this truth that I give you and be free and learn from me. Now, we could talk on and on and on and on, because those four words and things are the Christianese bingo card would have straight down the middle. We could talk how, here's what abiding looks like. Abiding is this. It's the opposite of autonomy, because autonomy says, I'm the center, and abiding says this. Hey, actually, I'm going to set up my life, Jesus, so that you're the center. Because abiding means this. I'm going to remain with you. I'm gonna so sit at your feet and be there and be near you and remain with you. We talk about disciple. He says the word disciple. Disciple means this, like, I'm going to follow you and learn from you, rabbi, teacher, and soak up everything you give me because I have so much to learn. Being a disciple is the declaration of saying this, I have so much to learn. There's so much I don't know, and even what I don't know, I don't know. We can talk about truth. Jesus is the Logos. He's what John 1 says is the Logos. Like, these eternal realities are seen in the flesh and in the person of Jesus. And we can talk about freedom, how Jesus comes to take the chains off of us. True freedom is marked by all of those things: abiding, disciple, truth, freedom. But Jesus really wants to take them deeper than just those things. Because Jesus, when he starts telling them, here's what true freedom looks like, he doesn't go back to abiding and disciple and truth and freedom. Here's what he really parks the bus on. He says, you will know true freedom when you are mine. Because true freedom can only come when you belong. True freedom can only come when you belong. What are the Jews trying to do in their false freedom? They're trying to say we belong because we're someone. And we're someone, therefore we belong. And yet Jesus decides to say, you will know true freedom when you belong. Look with me in verse 34. It says this. Jesus answered them, after they say, how can we be enslaved? Truly, truly, which basically means, hey, perk your ears up. If he says that, perk your ears up, because I'm about to dump truck, a Brinks truck on you. Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin, and the slave does not remain in the house forever. The Son remains in the house forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Listen, guys, I know you're the offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have seen from your father. What is Jesus trying to show them what true freedom looks like? True freedom is when you belong. And Jesus says, you're such a slave right now, actually, you can't even see that you're a slave. Actually, slavery has done such a number on you that actually you're all of a sudden thinking of the master that you're enslaved by as someone that's good. And I'm here to tell you this. You're a slave to the source of autonomy, which is this, sin. And sin would make you believe it's better for me to be outside of God's house, living in my own world, than living inside of God's house. And he's trying to tell you, I want you back in the house. I want you mine. I want you to know what my father has, because here I'm trying to tell you, I speak and I'm showing you what my father has given me, and I'm here to give it to you. I'm the Son, and I'm here to give you true freedom. What's true freedom? True freedom can only come when you belong, and I'm here to make you belong. And when you belong, you have rights, and you have riches, and you have relationship. You have everything that Jesus has because you're in his Father's house. That's what he's trying to get you to. That's what true freedom looks like. There's a story that Jesus tells in Luke 15, and it's well known by most folks, but here's kind of cliff notes. It's called the parable of the prodigal son, and really it should be called the prodigal sons. It's a whole another sermon or sermon series on its own. But here's what it is. He says the story, and it's this. It's that there's this father who has two sons, and the younger son comes to the father and says, hey, dad, I want my money. Give me what's due at me when you die. Basically, you are better to me dead than alive. I want my stuff more than I want you. And here's what his dad says. Okay. He gives him everything to him, his whole inheritance to them. And the son takes the money, and it says he goes to a far country, and he goes to this far country, and he has a great time. He drinks what he wants to drink. He eats and parties with who he wants to party with. He sleeps with whoever he wants to. And all of a sudden, though, that pot of inheritance goes from a lot to zero. So all of a sudden, inside of him, he's got no money. And also outside of him, it's not so good, too, because a drought hits. He needs a job. And he goes and he finds this job feeding pigs, which in this Jewish world is a big no-no. And he's going and he's feeding these pigs in the drought. Actually, hey, he's poor, so he has no money. So guess what? He starts eating the pig slop. He's gone from someone who belongs in his father's house to all of a sudden he's doing the no-no job, eating the same. He's kind of devolved into this person of eating the same food a pig eats. And it says, he comes to his senses. Something, there's a smelling salt that wakes up in him that says, wait a second. And again, here's the slave mentality in him. I'm a slave now, but the slaves in my dad's house, they eat pretty good. They don't eat this pig slop. They eat good stuff. Maybe I can go back and ask to be a slave in my dad's house, because at least that's better than what I'm doing now. And he has this whole speech rehearsed in his mind, and he says, okay, Father, I've sinned against you and against heaven. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Like, my sonship is gone. It's out of here. He has this speech in him. So he goes back, and his father, it says his father sees him from a far way off, and the father runs to him, which again was a big no-no in that day. He's breaking all the rules. But he's not breaking all the rules to get away from his son. He's breaking all the rules to get near his son. And what he does is, after this rehearsed speech has hit play of, I've sinned against you and against heaven, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son, the father does not even say anything to the son. The father says, hey, go kill the calf. Give me the rings, give me the robes, put it on this boy. He's mine, because we need to celebrate because my son was dead and now he's alive. It's a beautiful story. Throughout the years, keep reading it because you'll keep discovering the scandal of the gospel more and more and more. But what was the younger son's biggest problem? It was not that he broke the rules and asking for his inheritance. It's not that he was this kind of assuming younger son. It wasn't that he slept with all the wrong people. Like, his biggest problem wasn't prostitutes. It's crazy. His biggest problem wasn't that he was a bad financial planner and he lost all his money. His biggest problem wasn't that he broke all the ceremonial unclean laws. Here's what the younger son's biggest problem was. The younger son's biggest problem was that he didn't grasp how much he belonged to his father. And actually, that biggest problem had him believe this. Maybe I will have what I most want in the far country, because he didn't really believe he had it in his father's house. And what do the father's actions do when he returns? It's a reminder, you will always have me and you will always have a place in my house because you were dead, now you're alive, and therefore we celebrate because you're my boy. You're my son. This mantra of him believing, I'll be more free in the far country than in my father's house, and we see true freedom like we see in John 8 of Jesus telling these people, and he's telling us now, true freedom is when you really begin to realize and know the things that are on you are not chains. When you come to Jesus, the things that are on you is this, the robe and the rings, and the thing that's in your belly is the fattened calf that's been killed for you. Would you be so bold as to believe that's true of you? So my question for us is, what's your far country? He had a far country. He went off. He did all the bad no-no things out there. And I'm asking you to identify what's your far country. And I'm not going to say to you, don't go there. You shouldn't go there, though. I'm not going to say stop it. I'm asking you to identify what your far country is, like the younger son had. Because more importantly, I'm going to ask that question to ask this question. What do you believe is in the far country that you don't already have in the person of Jesus? Because how you answer that will show you that's what Jesus is trying to transform in you. That you can be truly, fully free because actually you begin to realize I belong all the more to this person of Jesus, and he's given me everything I need right now because I'm a son and I'm a daughter. I belong, and therefore I'm truly free. The key to live in true freedom is realizing you've been shaped more by sin than you ever can even know. And yet the key to living in true freedom is seeing Jesus is trying to wake you up to something that's already yours. Because actually, there's a reality about you that you need to know. And it's that you're rejoiced over. He rejoices over you as singing right now. that you have rights, that you're a son, that you're a daughter, that you have riches, that you have everything you need. You will never know not. You will never know the lack. He will give you exactly what you most need. And you have a relationship that his father is your father. You have all of this because you're truly free, and you're truly free because you're truly his. Jesus is not putting chains on you to enslave you. Jesus is putting rings on your fingers and robes on your shoulders and food in your belly because he's celebrating you, because you're truly his, because you're truly free, because you truly belong. Let me pray. Well, all this feels like a made-up story because the things that are real in my life actually would tell me I'm more enslaved than am I free. And yet, Jesus, that's the very point. Those feelings of enslavement and those feelings of bondage and those feelings of defensiveness and of striving, those feelings of self-importance, all of those things are the places you so want to transform with the realities that are already ours because you are who you say you are and we are who you say we are. That were yours. And so, Jesus, I pray that by the power of your Spirit, with the belonging we have to you, wash over us in a new way, that we would begin to see ourselves the way you see us. What you set us free. Because the Son's come for us, and the Son has said, you belong in my Father's house, and in my Father's house, you're rejoiced over. That you are sung over, that you are free, that you are redeemed, that you are have riches and relationship. We have all that we need because we are yours. So Jesus, give us eyes to see. Pray this all in your name, Jesus. Amen.